May it please the court, Mr. Shilat's sentence for being a felon in possession of a firearm was enhanced because it was the district court found that he possessed that firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking felony. The district court's decision was error for two reasons. First, the evidence was insufficient to support the conclusion that Mr. Shilat was engaged in a drug trafficking offense. I see the timer hasn't started.
Thank you.
I didn't want us to get lost.
You get a bonus.
Yes, sir. It was going to distract me. anyways, the evidence wasn't sufficient to show that he engaged in a drug trafficking offense. This court's recent decision in Hughes is the most analogous. There, the court dealt with a person who had 5.5 grams of methamphetamine and 3.4 grams of Adderall. The court found that the fish was only recently deceased. Here, Mr. Shilat.
There's an eminent panel that included me and Judge Englehart.
Yes, Your Honor. That's why I decided to focus on that one. Here, Mr. Shilat had even fewer, suggesting that the fish had been deceased quite a longer time. He had 4 grams of methamphetamine and 4.5 grams of marijuana. Also, as in Hughes, the things that Mr. Shilat possessed indicated that he was more of a consumer of narcotics than a distributor of them. For example, the grinder was used to prepare marijuana before you smoke it. And the government's going to point to the scale here. In other cases where the court has attached significance to a scale, there's been evidence that the scale had recent residue on it or that there were baggies used with the scale, the idea being that you would weigh the drugs before distributing them in those additional baggies. Here, there was no indication that Shilat had something to help him distribute the drugs, such as bags or things that you would use to cut drugs with. For those reasons, the evidence was insufficient to conclude that Mr. Shilat was engaged in drug trafficking. Also, sort of the circumstances of it, he had the drugs in his pocket. The scale was in the glove compartment, and the firearm was on the seat, on the floorboard in front of the back seat. And for those reasons, Mr. Shilat would urge the court to find that there was insufficient evidence to support the drug trafficking. The second error that the district court engaged in was once it concluded that Mr. Shilat was trafficking narcotics, it applied the automatic presumption of comment 14B to U.S. Guidelines 2K2.1, concluding that because the firearm and the drug trafficking were in close proximity, that Mr. Shilat had it was necessarily the case that the firearm was possessed in connection with the drug trafficking.
Counsel, you're aware that we heard en banc the Vargas case. I know it's extensively discussed. Would you agree that the outcome of that case would be determinative on this issue?
Yes, Your Honor. The outcome on that case would be at least highly probative of this issue. I think you would also have to accept my argument that 14B expands the application of 2K2.1 beyond what the guideline itself says, but I don't think that that's a hard leap to make, given that the guideline itself says in connection with, which U.S. versus Condren tells us means that it has a casual, causal connection or a logical connection, whereas here, once you get to the commentary, it eliminates the causal or logical connection and substitutes or expands on it by allowing only a spatial connection to satisfy. So yes, I do think Vargas will largely determine the outcome of that issue. But I guess to expand a little bit, assuming that Vargas does conclude that the Kizer review applies to the guideline commentary, the analysis this court would engage in is first whether the in connection with is a ambiguous term. As I just argued, I don't think it is ambiguous. This court has interpreted it before and used the typical canons of statutory construction to interpret it. Then we look to whether the even if I were to lose that argument and this court found it to be ambiguous, the next step would be to see if the commission's interpretation of it was reasonable because it does expand it. As the Third Circuit has found in Pettis, it would not be reasonable. And then finally, whether it's the kind of interpretation that an agency rather than a court should normally engage in, the argument there is that this court and many courts are very well practiced in engaging in this sort of analysis as to whether a firearm is possessed in connection with another felony. The courts do that in a lot of other contexts. And so this court, the courts are the ones who are well placed to engage in that sort of fact-intensive analysis as opposed to agency-created rules, which is reflected in the circuit splits that have come up even through the meaning of comment 14B, for example, in order to avoid finding that comment 14B was an unreasonable interpretation of the guideline. The Third Circuit in Perez, the majority opinion, found interpreted it significantly different than this court has. Instead of finding, as this court has, that it creates an irrebuttable presumption, the Third Circuit found that it created a rebuttable presumption. So the idea of an agency interpreting the regulation is to decrease the confusion that can arise. Here, even the attempt at interpretation has failed to achieve that goal. So for that reason, it also is not an interpretive exercise that agencies are well equipped to resolve. If there are no further questions, those are the two arguments that Mr. Shalott has for error in the district court.
And you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Fowler?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Charles Fowler for the United States. I will briefly touch on the factual question of whether the evidence supports a finding of drug trafficking, and then I'll move on to the legal question of the effect of Kaiser versus Wilkie here. As to the question of drug trafficking, the district court adopted the PSR's finding that this defendant was engaged in drug trafficking. This panel need only find that that was a plausible finding, and on this record, it was. This court has repeatedly been willing to infer drug trafficking from the type, the particular combination of circumstances we've got here, where we've got an individual with drugs on him, and in fact, multiple kinds of drugs. That's a common factor that this case has in common with Hughes that was discussed during Mr. O'Neill's argument. He's got drugs on him, he's got a gun on him, and it's not only the fact that he's got a gun on him, but it's the type of gun, the 9mm pistol, which is a common weapon of drug dealers, as well as the fact that, as the defendant admitted in the factual basis for his plea, it was readily accessible to him. Adding on top of that, it's the scale, which this court has considered, additional paraphernalia. Mr. O'Neill noted the grinder. That could be potentially a use-type paraphernalia, but that factor, again, was in common with Hughes, where the defendant had a pipe. But overall...
Counsel, let me ask you about the quantities. Are there any published Fifth Circuit cases that would support a finding of... evidence of intent to distribute? I think in this case it's 4 grams of methamphetamine and 0.16 ounces of marijuana. Do we have any published cases that might support your argument as to those, or ballpark on those amounts?
I'll direct the court to United States versus Smith, 6F4573. It's an 841 case, so it's dealing with the charge of possession with intent to distribute. I don't recall the precise amounts, but the court there made the observation, as the court has in other cases, that even small quantities can support an inference of intent to distribute if they're combined with other evidence like guns in proximity, scales in proximity. The totality of circumstances can support an inference. If you've got a large quantity, the quantity alone can support. Right. And I'm not sure we're quite there in this case. I would say I don't know that this is this 4 grams of methamphetamine is necessarily a user only quantity. I think it's kind of on the borderline. And just as a couple of relevant data points, I would note that you're just about 20% shy of what would be a 5-year man quantity under 841. I don't think that's dispositive, but I think it's just sort of a relevant marker to the kind of quantity we're talking about here. But overall, I think this court can readily affirm the finding that this defendant was dealing drugs. Turning to...
Do you think we ought to read proximity against the backdrop that he had had a constitutional right to carry a 9mm pistol?
Well...
In other words, when you, instead of getting... spatial proximity as distinguished from causal, as the Third Circuit has explained. The backdrop of this is that it's perfectly lawful for him to have that 9mm weapon. Now you say, well, that's a constitutional right, but if it gets in proximity to drugs, then that goes away. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about putting two of those concepts on the table.
Well, for one, this defendant was a convicted felon, so I don't think he had...
I'm not so sure that he don't have, still have a right under the Supreme Court of jurisdiction.
I don't think anyone's held since Bruin that a convicted felon had. In fact, something like 120, 130 district court decisions have rejected that argument unanimously. So I don't.
It's not an argument. I just.
Well,
that's you start with a constitutional premise, and you start taking it away. And you add to it that he's a prior felon. I'm not sure in the history of we go to the originalist approach that we're going to find explanation, but
certainly he didn't enjoy a constitutional.
I'm just pointing out some of the conundrum of where we're going.
Understood. Well, I don't think he enjoyed a constitutional right to possess illegal drugs.
And I don't suggest that.
Once you start combining the factors,
I understood.
So moving on to the issue of Kaiser versus Wilkie, this court has basically 29 years of unbroken precedent that would apply the other felony enhancement to the circumstances of this case. Assuming I'm right about the first point, that he was in fact dealing drugs, there's 30 years of precedent that would apply the enhancement to a case like this from both before and after Application Note 14 was adopted, and nothing in Kaiser versus Wilkie disturbs that precedent for three reasons. One is the panel held in Vargas. Of course, that decision has now been vacated, but I do think for present purposes, pending a decision in that case, the Vargas panel was correct that whatever Kaiser held, it does not unequivocally apply to the guidelines. Second, even if Kaiser applies to the guidelines in the abstract, the Supreme Court there emphasized that it was not meaning to upset or disturb settled rule constructions. That was the very reason the court decided not to depart from Hauer and Seminole Rock.
Well, the obvious question, though, is, I mean, you're making a perfectly fair presentation, but as a prudential matter, shouldn't we really wait for Vargas, an in-bank case that's been argued and will, of course, be decided in due course?
I don't think the court needs to, because my third point was going to be, I don't think the outcome is determined by deference to the note in this case. Like I said, there's a long line of precedent, starting with the U.S. versus Condren decision going back to 1994, that basically, this is 12 years before the application note was adopted, that basically applies the exact same logic that the Sentencing Commission came along and applied in 2006 in the application note. In Condren, the court said that if somebody's dealing drugs, then it's reasonable to infer that that person knows other people know he has drugs and would be concerned about theft. And if that's the case, it's further reasonable to infer that if he's got a gun, he's got the gun near his drugs, then he's doing so to protect the drugs. And that's, again, that's the logic this court laid out correctly. I think it makes intuitive sense that if you've got, and I think it's important to take a step back and think about the statute that this enhancement's applying to. It's knowing possession of a firearm. It's not.
Responded by relying on our case law. What's your strongest and most recent case that would support that?
So I think that probably...
I mean, I agree that your recitation is fair as to the case law, but which one would you point to the most?
I'd probably go to Anderson, U.S. versus Anderson from 2009, which is, we're fast-forwarding to 3 years after Application Note 14 was adopted, and that case applies the enhancement to similar facts. It's someone who was found with a gun and there was evidence that he had just been engaged in drug dealing. And interestingly, Anderson makes the observation that the note actually reinforced this court's prior practice. So I think that's an observation that, at least as far as this court's precedent goes, the note affirmed what the court had already been doing. The Sentencing Commission adopted essentially the logic from Condren that this court had adopted 12 years earlier. So again, going back to the analysis in Kaiser where the court said, look, we're not overruling Auer, we're not overruling Seminole Rock, and one of the reasons is that it would just cause a nightmare in admin law. We don't want to come along and upset decades worth of settled rule constructions. I think that logic applies here, and because we've got many, many cases following essentially the note's logic, and I think it's especially true when all the note did in this particular case was reinforce what the court was already doing and would not necessarily be outcome determinative here. I will touch briefly on the question of, say Vargas is decided tomorrow and holds that Kaiser deference applies equally to the guidelines. It's the government's position that the outcome of this case would still be the same. The court should affirm. First, because, like I said, I think the note is not outcome determinative. Precedent from both before and after would support the enhancement here. But even if you had to tick through Kaiser's framework in this case, we believe it would be proper to defer to the Sentencing Commission's reading of its enhancement here. The first question under Kaiser is whether the note is genuinely ambiguous. This note was promulgated to resolve effectively a division among the circuits about how to interpret this language, as the Third Circuit observed in the Perez decision from a year or so ago. The in connection with language is notable for its vagueness and pliability. It's just somewhat ambiguous language, so I do think it invites an interpretation by the commission. Turning to the question of whether this particular interpretation in application note 14B is within the zone of ambiguity, we believe it is a reasonable interpretation. The guideline requires in connection with, and the first part of 14A simply adopts basically what courts have adopted as the standard for in furtherance of or in relation to in the context of 924C, which, as Mr. O'Neill noted, requires a causal or logical connection. And 14B is consistent with that by essentially outlining one particular factual scenario where it makes sense to infer just such a causal or logical connection. In this case, the defendant had a gun, readily accessible, as he admitted in the factual basis, while he was drug dealing, so it makes all the sense in the world to just go straight down the chain of logical inferences that the Sentencing Commission contemplates, as well as Condren, back in 1994 contemplated. It's the same logic, and it's certainly a reasonable way to read this regulation. The Third Circuit posed this in the Perez case, which is the only post-Kaiser case, by the way, dealing with this particular enhancement and whether, how Kaiser might affect it, poses a sort of hypothetical scenario where somebody's dealing drugs and has a hunting rifle buried in the closet. So there's this sort of proverbial accidental or coincidental possession of a gun in close proximity to drugs. I struggle with that a little bit because I think the Third Circuit is discounting the notion that the person, by definition, if we're talking about a 922 charge, knows the gun is there. So I think even if it is a hunting rifle buried in the closet, you might be able to infer, depending on the circumstances, that it's got at least the potential to facilitate the drug trafficking. But regardless, this case is not the hunting rifle buried in the closet case. There's no need to get into whether whether that is, you know, is satisfies the in connection with requirement. Certainly no application of the note to this case would be remotely unreasonable. So even under Kaiser, the government believes that the application of the enhancement was proper in this case. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fowler. Mr. O'Neill, rebuttal.
I'd like to start by providing a little bit of context for what was agreed to in the factual basis. The government relies heavily on the admission in the factual basis that Shalhat had immediate access to the firearm. That was in the context of a sentence that reads like this from Record 79. As the driver and sole occupant of the vehicle, Shalhat had immediate access to the firearm and therefore exercised care, custody, and control of the firearm. In that context, the factual basis is really just establishing sole as opposed to joint possession. It doesn't do the work that the government wants it to of making it seem like, you know, the firearm was ready for there for him to grab it and defend any narcotics. The government also refers to United States versus Sharp 6F4573. I think that's very distinguishable from this case. There was a sufficiency of the evidence analysis about whether there was enough to conclude an intent to distribute. The defendant there had sent text messages as well as admitted on the stand to trading drugs for guns. So I think the argument here that I think this scenario is definitely lesser than Sharp and lesser than Hughes in showing an intent to distribute just based on what he had with him and the amount of drugs he had in his possession. Finally, the government says that Shalhat is that Condren and the comment 14B are consistent. I think this court has rejected that argument in United States versus Mitchell, 166F3D748 in 1999. This court wrote, quote, there is no conclusive presumption, either statutory or jurisprudential, that a connection exists automatically between guns and drugs. Comment 14B makes that connection, and therefore it expands on what this court had already found in Condren because it expands the text of the guideline. It is not deserving of deference. The district court erred by deferring to it, and Shalhat would urge reversal in this case.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Neal. Your case is under submission. We notice that you're court appointed. We wish to thank you for your willingness to take the appointment and for your good work on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.